Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for July 28th, 2008, and on this episode, Tom Williams interviews Laura Phillip. They'll be talking about her latest show, Cyrano Translated. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, Chicago, and let's talk theater.
This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our guest this week is Laura Phillip, who is a performer, singer, dancer, triple threat, artistic director, director, and now playwright. Hello, Laura.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Great. Tell us about your new play.
Our new project. The name of the play is Cyrano Translated, and it is based loosely, to start on a very small scale level, on the play Cyrano de Bergerac, which is, you know, a show that's been very much loved over the ages and transformed into different tellings, such as Roxanne, over the years. And so we've taken that as the grain of an idea and expanded it into something quite a bit more grand, I think.
Okay. What got you interested in that for a play?
Well, our company, Ouroboros Theater Company, we have been together for about 4 years as a group of people, and you know, we kept talking about shows that we wanted to do in the future, and Cyrano kept coming up over and over again because the root of our mission is to really explore great stories that have been told through history, and Cyrano is really one of the great tales that's out there and connects with so many people, and we all just really loved it and loved the characters and everything that it had to say. So we thought about doing the actual Edmond Rostand Cyrano de Bergerac within our season, and we were kind of ramping up for that and getting ready to start talking production meetings. And then they announced that they were going to do it on Broadway. They were doing that short run with Kevin Kline and Jennifer Garner. And we thought, you know, rather than trying to appear like we were dovetailing off of the Broadway production, that we should reexamine the piece and see if there was maybe another approach that we could take to it. So we started talking about different ideas. We had some very interesting ideas being thrown around. At one point, we were talking about doing the play in French and having it told through Roxanne's point of view in French, and then having the action take place to sort of serve as subtitles. And we thought that might be a little bit difficult for audiences to relate to. So we then started talking about the fact that there was a historical person, Sauvignon de Cyrano, who lived in the 1600s, who the play was very loosely based upon, and we thought, well, maybe we'll look at doing a biographical look at that man. So I started doing some research on him, and through doing that research, I realized that he was wildly different, at least on the surface, from the man that Edmond Rostand created when he created his lead character of Cyrano for his play. So that was the beginning of the inspiration for the play.
Okay, so you had the historic, an actual historical person.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Well, but you certainly like to have ambitions, so
yes, of course. I couldn't just leave it at that, right?
Right. So now you had. Right. Now tell us about the second story, because actually, there's three.
There are three stories. Exactly.
Stories that marvelously blend.
Oh, thank you. Well, when I realized that the historical Cyrano was so different from Rostand's Cyrano, I decided to do some research into Rostand's writing of the piece to try and figure out why he did what he did. And discovered that his story was absolutely fascinating as well. And then I just sort of got interested in the thread of Cyrano from the beginning through to present day and what's been done with the story, and started looking at the first American writers who translated Rostand's piece from French to English and brought it to America for, you know, a public American audience. And that's when I discovered the third storyline that you're referring to, which was Brian Hooker. And he was one of the first American translators of the show. There were a couple of others before him, but his is considered the most poetic, the most beautiful version, and is also the version that had its popular broad run on Broadway. So I kind of started looking at him. What was interesting was that you found a lot of reviews about his version of the show, but there wasn't a lot of information out there about him. And that's when I kind of decided, well, I'm gonna take him and do to Brian Hooker basically what Edmond Rostand did to Cyrano, and use him as, you know, the germination of an idea, and then expand that into something a bit more fictional for the purpose of telling the story that we wanted to tell. And that's just how, you know, a person can actually become art through the telling of their story over and over again.
Yeah, and you cover the effects of creating art, of telling the stories on their family, because each of them have their family.
Yes, exactly. You know, one of the things that was interesting is that Cyrano de Bergerac, the play, you know, he is in love with his cousin Roxanne, who is based on another historical person who really was Sauvignon de Cyrano's cousin, who actually went by the name Madeleine. And there is a line in Cyrano de Bergerac where she's referred to as Madeleine. So, you know, you find these little glimmers of historical accuracy, but then it's, you know, it's been transformed so much that it's hardly recognizable anymore. But, you know, he did have this cousin named Madeleine who he was very close with, but it was never a romantic relationship. In point of fact, Cyrano was quite well known for the fact that he carried on a love affair with a peer and writer and musician of the time by the name of Charles de Sacy. So, you know, that's wildly different from what Rostand portrayed him in a romantic light. So, you know, you get the relationship with Charles, his lover. You get the relationship with his cousin, Madeleine, that you find is not a romantic relationship. You know, and again, as I said, Rostand had an amazing story of his own and really, really suffered through the trials and tribulations of being a writer and dealing with success as well as failure and all of the expectations that he put upon himself. But he had a wife who was a very talented writer in her own right. Her name was Rosemont Gerard, and she's written some prose and verses that the people now would be familiar with. You know, they appear on a lot of Valentine's Day cards and wedding invitations, actually.
Oh.
The verse that she quotes in the play that she's discovering, the "Today I love you more than yesterday and less than tomorrow," is one that I think a lot of people sort of are familiar with in the back
yes.
of their mind. But she is the one who came up with that. So she was a very talented writer, and they had a very tumultuous relationship. You know, as well as then looking at a relationship that we created for Brian Hooker, where he's really kind of having a second coming of age story in a way, where he's trying to deal with, you know, his inner artist coming out and how that affects his relationships as well. So, yeah, there's a lot wrapped in our little play.
Yeah, and then you add the character who discovered the letters from the original Cyrano. Is that fact, or is
you
that...
know, one of the things, it's interesting, it's a little blend of fact and fiction there, because
okay.
one of the things that, as I was doing the research on Sauvignon de Cyrano from the 1600s, he has this nickname of the godfather of science fiction, because he wrote this series of stories called the Journey series, is what they're known as, Journeys to the Other Worlds. And there was a Journey to the Sun and a Journey to the Moon that were published posthumously for him by his best friend, Lebret, who's another character whose name appears in Rostand's Cyrano, interestingly enough. But Lebret took these writings and edited them down and actually censored them so that they wouldn't be quite as insightful to the church. But there was thought to be a third story, which was the Journey to the Stars, and it has been thought that manuscript has been destroyed or lost over the ages. And so one of the main principles of the show that we created was that it wasn't lost. It had been, you know, hidden and passed down throughout the generations of Cyrano's bloodline, because he was trying to protect his original work.
Well, that's been done quite a bit, so
yeah.
That's not too much of a stretch.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just thought it would be fascinating if that actually happened and we got, you know, a really pure look at what his writing was like, because it's been quite distilled throughout the ages because of the fact that it was edited and censored so much after he died.
Well, you know, one of the things I liked about the play was the way you staged it, and you're at the West Theater at the theater building, and it's a good sized stage.
Mm-hmm.
That you didn't skimp on the costumes. I mean, they're period perfect in each era, the 1650s and then, what, 1890s
and
then 1920s. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a big consideration for us, and we really lucked out. John Guion, who is our costumer, is just fantastic and has been very generous with us and loves doing period pieces, so he was just eating up the idea of being able to portray these three different time periods. And you know, I felt that it was really important to show the differences between the three time periods. And of course, I mean, I'd like to have a huge budget and go even further with that.
Well, I mean, the hair was accurate. The dresses, yeah,
it was all important to us. We're about the details of production value, because I think so many times you go to see a show and sometimes those little details are missed, and it kind of pulls you out of the story a bit. And
I
really
agree.
Wanted to immerse this audience in all three of these stories.
Well, then the other thing that I think you covered real well was the reaction of actors to the script with I mean, Ron Keaton, who's one of the real top pros in Chicago.
Well, we're so blessed to have him.
Yeah. Tell us about his role, because he adds a lot of flavor, kind of the actor's point of view.
It is a bit of the actor's point of view, absolutely. One of the things that we did that we thought was kind of fun was there was an actor in the 1890s who portrayed Cyrano and was very, very well known for it, and quite a character by the name of Constant Coquelin. And he was very famous, great friends with Sarah Bernhardt, good friends with the Rostands, very famous in his time. He originated the role of Cyrano. And then Ron also plays Walter Hamden, who in the 1920s originated the role on Broadway. And in fact, actually, after the original Broadway run, he took the show and produced it several times himself because he loved it so much. And through Ron, we definitely get this this story of how actors related to this piece and how important it was to them. And Ron is just, he's fantastic. And he's since become a company member of Ouroboros as well. So we're really excited to have him on board.
So being a new company, but I appreciate the fact that you want to have an equity company,
mm-hmm.
at least one contract.
Yeah. You know, Chicago is a great city in the fact that they are really trying to find ways to make the prospect of becoming an equity company more feasible for small companies, for young companies, and really trying to build those possibilities of partnerships with companies so that there's more work for equity actors, and you know there's a larger sense of credibility by becoming an equity theater and having the union behind you and what you can offer, you know, to your actors through that. And I'm a member of Actors Equity myself, so you know it was kind of an obvious next step for us to take, so that you know, that my partnership made sense on both sides of the coin. And you know, there really is something about the fact that we have taken that step to do that, because I just think it says something about, you know, where we intend on going and how serious our intentions
are. Yeah, so. Well, it certainly does. Plus, it gives you the flexibility of, you know, how many shows are that one actor away?
Right,
you know, you need that one
Absolutely.
Top pro.
Yeah, definitely. And they make it really, really possible to do. So, you know, we're really grateful for Equity and their role in all of this, because they've just been fantastic.
Well, one of the things that I liked about the show that I've got to ask you about is you keep referring to the Cyrano factor.
Yes.
Give us a little
my little invention.
Do
you like that?
Yeah.
The Cyrano factor. Yeah. You know, it's funny because I made a joke about the fact that after I wrote the play, I pretty much put everything interesting and clever that I had said in normal conversations to people in the play for the last 2 years, and I really was out of interesting things to say for a while, because that was just a conversation that I had with someone, I don't know, over coffee or something, and I said, you know, it's interesting. It's talking about people having this thing that is universally attractive to other people, and I thought, God, it's a Cyrano factor. You know, Cyrano had this wonderful way with words and the way he could write his letters and his poetry, and it just captured your heart. And I don't know, that phrase just kind of jumped out at me. So I've adopted it.
Yeah, and of course, you got to come see the play to really catch what that does.
Yes.
The other thing I liked is this isn't just sort of a biography of mm-hmm. of Cyrano's work.
Right.
But it's, to me, it really is about the effects of creating art.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, and, you know, there's that whole saying that, you know, we all know, where they talk about life imitating art, imitating life. And, you know, we've heard that a million times, and I think we take for granted the truth behind that, because there really is a reflection of life within art. And, you know, again, I thought it was interesting, this concept, this notion that, you know, we can be living our life every day just as we would live it, and who knows, you know, 100 years down the road, someone finds out something out about us, and it inspires them to write your story or create a story around the inspiration of just you being alive. And I think there's something very powerful in that, and the fact that we are so connected, and that there really is this ripple effect in life as well as in art. So, I mean, that's definitely one of the main premises of the show, that it's very
And how we really don't control our legacy,
exactly,
do we?
Exactly, no.
Yeah.
you know, someone, you know, can take our story and take a glimmer of it that connects to something within themselves and, you know, write their own story based on that. So, you know, it's interesting. It's deep subject matter.
Yeah, and it comes off well. I mean, this is, as I said, this is a thinking person show.
It is. And, it definitely is.
And it's, you deliberately did it in sort of a melodramatic, well, tell us why you did that, because I thought your explanation when you told me earlier, that was pretty good.
Sure, and you know, it's not something that's going to be for everybody, and I kind of knew that going into it, and I felt like that connected me to these writers as well, because they all knew as they were writing their pieces that, you know, this was going to be stuff that people were either going to connect to and they were going to get and they were going to love, or they were going to turn around and go, oh my gosh, I can't deal with this, it's too much for me, I don't like it. But, you know, part of it was really in keeping with the traditions of the time periods as well. If you look at the time periods, I mean, the writing in the 1600s was, you know, very dense. And
yeah, you know, the speech, everybody, when they said hello, the speech was 10 minutes, right?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, we're kind of keeping true to those time periods. The 1890s was an extremely expansive artistic time in history, and there was a lot of melodrama going on. And if you look at the writing of the play Cyrano de Bergerac itself, it's beautifully written, and it's extremely romantic, and it's very epic. And you know, we are keeping in with that tradition of the time.
You wanted to give people the flavor,
absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of the dialogue in the show is taken directly from quotes from these characters. So it's not like I sat down here and came up with really romantic ways to say these things. These were things that these people said.
Well, you know? What I've told a lot of people is it's kind of like Shakespeare in a sense that you got to tune into it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
But once you do, you know, all entertainment, you can't be spoon-fed. Something
right.
You have to work at.
Right.
But once you do the payoff, you get into the language and the payoff and the characters are just become alive.
Right. And the way that we tried to connect the three time periods so that wasn't so jarring was that if you listen to the script, there are words and phrases and things that repeat themselves between the time periods. So they are connected, and it's not just like going from 1600s dialogue to 1890s dialogue to 1920s dialogue. There are things that connect each of the three time
periods.
Well,
tell us how you cast this role, because there's some terrific performances.
I'm so lucky. I'm the luckiest director on the planet. This is a fantastic cast, and I love them all, and they've just been a joy to work with. And again, one of the principles behind our theater company is finding people who have like spirits and who are generous of nature and talented and, you know, come into this with, you know, a great passion and love for it. So we had a pretty amazing audition process. We had a lot of turnout for it. We had an amazing set of callbacks. And beyond that, we actually attended the ITAs this year, which is an Illinois Theater Association general audition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, a 2 or 3 day, I think it's actually, I can't remember if it's 2 or 3, but it's a few days where you basically sit in a room and you get to see about 300 people come through. And, you know, you find that there's a lot of talent just coming out of college. There are a lot of people who are kind of new in town. And you get a really fresh perspective on the kind of talent that is available out there that you might not see through other...
Chicago is an amazing town for young talent,
isn't
it? Oh,
it's unbelievable.
Yeah,
it's
that's why I said if you can't cast here, you can't cast anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, give us some of the key people. I know Scott Sumerick, who's
Scott,
been a favorite
Scott
of mine.
Scott Sumerick is amazing, and he... is one of the most multi-talented people you'll ever meet. He's another one who, you know, he sings, he dances, he acts. He's our technical director on the company. He has a million different skill sets. But, you know, we made him work for the role. He came into callbacks, and I was like, all right, Scott, show us what you got. And he, you know, he had a really wonderful sense of the character. And then through the process, he has just grown and grown and grown. And literally within, I would say, the last 3 days of the rehearsal process, all of a sudden clicked into Rostand and just absolutely inhabited the character.
Yeah.
It was thrilling.
So I think it's the best thing he's done, and he's done some good stuff.
It was thrilling to see him develop into this character, and I'm just so delighted with how he's turned out.
What about this young man that played the young Cyrano?
Cyrano, mm-hmm, yeah. Jonathan French. He is one of those actors that we found through ITAs. He actually had not even moved here yet. He was based in Atlanta, Georgia, and was thinking about moving to Chicago and came to the ITAs, and he just leapt out at me as someone who is going to be perfect for this show. There is just a spirit about him that fits in with the character of Cyrano. There's sort of an edginess as well as a vulnerability, as well as just really incredibly deep acting skills on top of that. And
I thought he
language.
Was, he's a real find.
He's a real find, and he's going to do really well in this city. And I literally, you know, ran out into the hall to find him before he left after the auditions because he had his old information on his resume. I was like, wait, are you in Atlanta? Are you here? What are you doing? And he's like, I'm moving here. So, you know, we kind of grabbed him right off the train. I'm so fortunate that we found him because he's perfect.
And of course, I like Michael Sherwin as Brian Hooker.
He is fantastic. He's absolutely fantastic. And here's a little bit of trivia for you.
What's that?
He was actually originally cast in the in Ron Keaton's role, the Constant Coquelin role, because we had another actor, a good friend of ours, who was cast in the Brian Hooker role, and ended up getting a professorship out at a college out of state and ended up having to move. And that was kind of when the Ron thing happened because we thought, well, we need to replace this other actor. What are we going to do? And Ron had been in talks with us about becoming a company member. He'd been involved in some of the readings, and we thought, well, we can't do an equity contract. And then we thought, well, you know what? Why not? Let's look at it.
Yeah.
So we moved Michael into the Brian Hooker role, and we brought Ron on. And I'm so thankful that all happened. You know, I mean, everything happens for a reason. And
yeah.
And this is a really
well,
clear
let's,
case.
Well, let's
that.
Not slight. The ladies,
because
there are some
gosh.
Fantastic.
The ladies.
And you know, my pet peeve is you know, we've talked about this, are the young female actors who mumble and don't project.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, you cast some gals that can really, I mean, they're terrific.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm so proud of the entire cast. And the women, you look at a show like this and you think, gosh, it's based on the three male writers who were involved in Cyrano de Bergerac, and you think it's going to be you know, a male-centric show, and it's just not the case. The women are equally as important and just fantastic. Erin Ordway, who I worked with on Bohemian Theater Ensemble's production of Electra, is just outstanding.
Yes, she is.
As Madeline. She just has so much depth to what she does and such a beautiful, natural grace to her. She's just perfect. And Alex Dorsey, who plays Rose, who is Rostand's wife, she was another ITA find as well, if I remember correctly. And she is fresh out of Northwestern and just an incredible talent and going to do really great things. You know, and then you've got Courtney Boxwell, who is a young Chicago actress who's playing the fictional character of Renee, who is the descendant of Cyrano's, you know, bloodlines, who has this lost work of his. And she's just, you know, wonderful as well and lights up the stage when she gets out there. And you know, you and I both, I think, love Maura Kidwell about as
yes.
much as anyone can love an actress. She is just...
And she, for a small role, she made everything out of it. She got some real beautiful... Mm-hmm. I was kidding her. I said, your comic timing was terrific.
She steals the show.
Yeah.
She absolutely does. And it's thrilling to me because Doris is a character who I think could get really lost. And she is exactly what she needs to be. It's a person who has a lot of depth to them, but is a quiet soul, and her strength is really from within, and it takes a lot to bring it out of her, but she has all this wisdom and this fire and this energy and this humor behind her. And Maura actually was my prototype for that role. I had her pictured in my mind for that role from the beginning of writing it. So
that's good.
Yeah, we were talking about what a journey it's been to talk about, you know, doing this show months and months and months ago, you know, driving around, you know, on the way to another show, and to have it now up and running is just, it's amazing. And I'm so glad that she ended up being the person who is.
Well, this is an important work, and because of what you attempted to do. And let's give a little commercial for it. So Cyrano translated.
Yep.
It's at the theater building. What days are you running?
We are running Friday and Saturday nights at 7:30, as well as Sunday afternoons at 2:30.
Okay, and you're running through, what, August 3rd?
August
right?
3rd. We've got two more weeks left.
So you don't have a lot of time to get out there, folks, but this is definitely worth seeing because it's an ambitious play. It's beautifully written, and you did a great job. And again, you did a great job directing and casting.
Thank you.
So tell us about your theater group and what got you started on that, because you're a very successful equity actress, a triple threat, and you've been in some great shows.
Thank you. Thank you. I really love performing, and I'm so thankful to be doing it when I'm doing it. You know, I tend to be a little bit split focused as a person, and I have a lot of different things I'm interested in doing, and I've always really loved the production end of things. I did a lot of my early career out at the Pheasant Run Dinner Theater in St. Charles when it was run by Diana Martinez. I know I'm probably dating myself by saying that, but anyone who has seen anything out there when she was doing it knows that she had a really high production value, and the people that she cast were always really wonderful, and I really feel like she was my mentor, and she gave me a lot of early opportunities to do a little bit of directing alongside her, as well as some writing. I wrote some shows for the children's theater out there and was lucky enough to have those produced and got a little taste of directing doing those as well, and I just really liked it. I really liked using that other side of my brain and kind of delving into the business side of things, and I really like casting, and I really like being immersed in the whole picture of theater instead of just performing in it.
Well, I thought you did a great job as Christine in Porchlight's
Phantom. Oh, thank you so much. That was really fun show.
I'm wishing you luck because in the next few weeks the nominations will come out, and your show was Jeff recommended.
Yeah. I am just happy to have been a part of it. It was really fun.
And tell us about that at that experience of Ravinia for Most Happy Fellow with George Hearn. I mean, everybody.
Absolutely one of my favorites to date.
And, you know, everybody who's anybody in Chicago theater was in that show, and you were one of them.
Oh, thank you. Well, I just had the time of my life. I mean, the show itself is beautiful, and not many people do it because it's a big cast, and it's, you know, it's one of those shows that's it's expensive, and it's just, it's a lot to try to chew. But they did something really ambitious, I thought, because in the past they've done, you know, probably a musical a season, and they've done it more as a concert version. And then, you know, you hire someone like Mark Robin as your director, and you know you're going to get more than you asked for.
For sure.
So what Mark did was he came in and he said, you know, we're going to actually do the show. We're doing the show full out with choreography, with costumes, off book. I mean, we did a full-on production. I couldn't
believe
it.
You sure did.
And we put that thing up in like 5 days.
Yeah. And, you know, I told the people at Ravinia, I said, why didn't you have great performances out here to videotape this?
Yeah.
You know, so the whole world could have seen it. It was really one of those great nights of theater.
Thank you. It was something to be a part of, I tell you. It was just beautiful.
Well, tell us some of your ambitions now that for yourself and for your company.
Sure.
You know, like, where do you want to be in the next few years?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I started the company as a labor of love because, you know, so many times when you're a performer, we're often lucky enough to work with people that we like because you develop relationships. But, you know, you don't have control over who you're working with and what you're working with or what you're working on all the time. And I have a very close group of friends who we've all been professionals in the city for, you know, a lot of years, as well as kind of pulling in some of this new talent that we've been talking about. And we thought, you know, we want to create for ourselves and for the Chicago community an artistic home that's doing more good work and, you know, really into getting back to the basics of theater, which is all about storytelling and connecting with people. And we thought, you know, what the heck? Let's do this. There are a lot of companies out there, of course, and a lot of them don't make it. But we thought we're going to put everything that we can into this and make it a success because we feel like we have the experience behind us to do it. The name of the company is Ouroboros Theater Company, and, you know, we found the name because it's that old ancient symbol of the snake in a circle eating his tail, and it really represents the cycle of life and about how...
Give us the spelling of the URL.
Well, can't figure that out? Come on. It's O-U-R-O-B-O-R-O-S. It's all O's except for that one little U in the beginning.
Ouroboros. Theatercompany.com.
It's just OuroborosTheater.com, and theaters with an R-E. But, yeah, please check out the website because, you know, one of the things that we're really keen on is not just bringing main stage theater to Chicago, but we also do a lot of outreach programs. We like the idea of bringing storytelling in a theatrical format to venues that are literally outside the box. We do a lot of work out at the Wharton Arboretum, which is in Lyle, and it's a beautiful 1,400-acre, you know, living museum of trees and just all sorts of beautiful plants. And
I've heard also that you have a program for younger people
and
at the school.
Exactly. We've started a theater for young audiences wing, and we are embarking on our first school tour this fall, which is a two-man show based on the fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm. And it's basically a trunk show where these two men bring four of their stories to the kids, and they play like 60 characters.
Great. I congratulate you on that because we need to bring theater to the kids so we can get the younger
audience.
Absolutely.
We need a next generation. And, you know, kids, they're the ones who, I think, connect to stories the most. When we're children, we love stories. We love telling stories. We love playing dress up. We love hearing them. I mean, all of these things. And I just think theater is a wonderful way to really connect storytelling to kids and get back to that oral tradition that kind of gets lost in the mix of everything that we've got in our modern society.
Well, you guys have set the bar nice and high. I mean, I hope you can find another place to remount Cyrano Translated.
Thank you. We're going to work on it. And, yeah. You know, we've got some exciting things in the mix for next season as well.
Have you figured out your shows yet?
Well, we have a few things on the short list, so okay. I'm not really ready to say yet. But after next week, we're probably going to start looking into finalizing our decisions, and we'll have it up on the website soon. So
great.
Yeah, it should be a very exciting year for us.
Well, Laura, thank you so much.
And thank you.
One of the treats of the summer was coming to see your show. I mean, I came because I know you're a talent, you know, and I know some people in the cast. Mm-hmm. But boy, I love being surprised by this. And so there was some top equity people or, you know, friends of yours and friends around that were there. And everybody was just saying they couldn't believe what a great piece of art it was and a nice piece of theater.
It's just incredibly rewarding to feel like we're connecting with some people. So we're very happy with that.
Wow. Well, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And folks, go see a play this week.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of July 28th, 2008. Profiles Theater has announced their 20th anniversary season, following up its sold-out Season of LaBute last season, which featured four premieres by playwright Neil LaBute. And now their next season is the most ambitious offering in the company's 20-year history. It'll include a world premiere, a U.S. premiere, and two Midwest premieres, beginning with the first full Chicago production of Jason Wells' dark comedy, Men of Tortuga, that starts on October 3rd. The dark comedy, The Thugs, opens on October 25th. The acclaimed new play, Great Falls, begins on January 9th. An original Scottish play, The Wonderful World of Dissocia, starts on March 20th, and the world premiere comedy, Graceland, starts on May 22nd. For more information about Profile's most ambitious 20th anniversary season, click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. City Lit Theater's artistic director Terry McCabe has announced their 2008-2009 season, which will be City Lit's 29th. It'll consist of Dashiell Hamlet by Mike Nowak, Mike Nussbaum, Kathleen Thompson, and Paul H. Thompson. Also, The Confession by Mary Roberts Reinhardt, Scoundrel Time by Lillian Hellman, and in rotating rep, Old Times by Harold Pinter and Private Lives by Noel Coward. For more information on the performance schedule of CityLit's 29th season, visit citylit.org. Again, that's citylit.org. Cirque du Soleil has added the final 18 shows to the Chicago engagement of Cusa. The final performance will now be on August 24th under the blue and yellow Grand Chapiteau at the United Center. Cusa is a return to the origins of Cirque du Soleil, who combine acrobatic performance and the art of clowning with a visual feast full of surprises. Check out Cusa before it leaves on August 24th. For information on how to get tickets, check out our Now Playing section. The Jeff Awards Committee has announced that starting with this current non-equity theater season, which began on April 1st, all non-equity awards categories will now be competitive, with only a single recipient chosen from the nominees. The exceptions, however, are the categories of new work and new adaptation. They will remain non-competitive. This now brings the non-equity Jeff Awards under the same rules as the equity Jeff Awards. Stay tuned to Talk Theater in Chicago as the events unfold. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Laura Phillip for giving us the honor of interviewing her this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.